You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, translated by Matthew Barton. It's 12 lectures. This is Lecture 3, given on the 28th of March, 1916. Today I have undertaken to discuss some aspects of history from a particular spiritual scientific perspective. Here, I must ask you to remember, since I can only give brief outlines of such matters on the passing wings, let us say, of the spirit, that only glimpses will be offered of this or that historical aspect. It will not be possible, in this fleeting way, to investigate immediate causes and effects, as we are used to doing in mainstream history. The first thing to consider is, as we are aware through our science of the spirit, that behind everything that happens in the world, spiritual powers, spiritual intentions, spiritual aims are at work. If one studies history in an external way, it naturally only affords us the outward historical mechanism in which the living reality of spiritual aims and intentions manifest. A trained seer is here largely aware of the direct spiritual streams and processes that underlie events. But in such accounts, we must not think that the person giving them is seeking to make a tangible, specific connection between actual events and the realities he is describing. That is not the case. All that I will try to do, as I stated, is to offer a glimpse here and there of the deeper powers that remain unseen both in an outward study of material historical facts and likewise in an account of facts such as those I will present today. However, if we place underlying realities and historical facts alongside each other, we can gain a picture of what happens in the world. Here I must mention someone with whom you are all familiar, H.P. Blavatsky. As you all know, she was an especially psychically gifted individual, living at the time that witnessed the high tide of materialism, and was involved in a very distinctive way in the spiritual movements of the second half of the 19th century. In her, we find an eminently psychic individual engaged with what was otherwise very materially oriented activity, on which all science in the second half of the 19th century was more or less dependent. Now, H.P. Blavatsky was not someone you would call a medium in the ordinary sense, but really a very, very remarkably psychic person in the profoundest sense. To fully understand her, at least to some degree, we have to study the milieu she emerged from. She was brought up in Russian surroundings, and the way in which her spirit and body interrelated was also characteristically Russian. This has to be seen as very unusual, abnormal. And here, we have to discern the degree to which, due to national characteristics, the Russian people diverge from the people of Western and Central Europe. The inhabitants of Western and Central Europe have continued and, in a certain sense, creatively reconfigured the culture which emerged from the fourth post-Atlantean era, the Greco-Roman. What once lived in the Greco-Roman era continues and is furthered by Central and Western Europe. And this is due solely to the fact that in Western and Central Europe, people's physical bodies developed into special instruments for, among other things, spiritual activity, for thinking, feeling, and will. Western and Central Europe were distinguished by the achievements of thinking, feeling, and will, mediated by the body. The Slavic people of Eastern Europe, and the Russian people in particular, are different in this respect. Thorough mechanization of the physical body, as in Western and Central Europe, simply cannot occur in the Russian people if they retain their national characteristics. One cannot understand the Russian people with Western European forms of thought. It is only possible to understand them if we know about the human etheric body. You see, the most salient expressions of Russian life do not enter the physical body, as in Western and Central Europe, but unfold more in the etheric body, rather than penetrating the physical body. In the Russian people, the etheric body has a much, much greater importance than it still has for the people of Western and Central Europe, and also for the American people, the latter quite especially. And this is why a direct, strong I, capital, can never develop in the Russian people. The people, mind you, not the ruling circles, to the same degree as in Western and Central Europe. Their I will always possess a dreamy inflorescence, a dreamlike quality. The way in which the I still lives in us in the fifth post-Atlantean era is determined by characteristic ways in which the physical body develops. During this fifth post-Atlantean era, the Russian people are not meant to reach the point of directly developing the I as such. The I is not at all intended to impress itself into the physical body with all that lives and weaves in the etheric body. Naturally, these words are an approximation only, since words have not yet been coined to express spiritual realities. If I say, in quotes, dreamlike, a materialist might come along and demonstrate that the people of this nation are not in the least dreamy, and so forth. But these are all external objections that actually have nothing at all to do with real inner developments. We can, therefore, say that the national traits rooted in the Russian people as yet cannot come to outward manifestation, and that this people has been impressed from without, for the time being, by something that develops and gives expression to qualities and characteristics quite opposed to their real nature. H.P. Blavatsky largely grew out of this Russian culture, and so we can understand that in her, to an enormous degree, the activity of the etheric body, in as much as it is cognitive activity, outweighed all physical activity. We, therefore, have in H.P. Blavatsky very much an individual who can experience a great deal, an infinite amount, in her etheric body. This is, of course, a quite different order of experience from that granted through thinking and perception, mediated by the physical brain. By the very fact, therefore, that Blavatsky emerged from Russian culture, she can experience an infinite amount in her etheric body. But connected with this is the lack of qualities, really, she did lack them, that a Western European finds indispensable if he seeks revelations from worlds of spirit. Blavatsky lacked all means to think logically, to group her perceptions in a logical way, to say two things one after the other, in which the second follows from the first. Thus, if we try to translate the inner visions she had in her etheric body into our mode of cognition in Western and Central Europe, we always get a sense of a mill wheel spinning round in our head. Unless we ourselves have a tendency to dismiss serious modes of thinking, inevitably we will experience what Blavatsky wrote as a mill wheel revolving in our head. But nevertheless, what suffused her via her etheric body and came to disorderly expression through her etheric power of cognition still contained significant revelations from the world of spirit. It is important to retain our critical faculty in regard to such things, and see them as they are, rather than reading what she wrote in the same way as, say, some scientific or other book, which finds its ordinary place in our modern culture. Thus, at a time when humanity was to pass through what one might call its highest charge of materialism, an individual such as Blavatsky appeared. This is simply a fact we must acknowledge. Someone is present who emerged from Eastern European culture, and yet who had in her blood, as heredity, a dash of Central European quality. This is very easy to show in her ancestry. This too was present in her, though greatly overlaid by an Eastern European element. Something that leads toward logical understanding in Central Europe and to will initiative, which the Russian does not intrinsically have at all. What did this result in? If we take the two extreme poles and combine them, we can say that ultimately, as we can study in the many English books by Blavatsky available to us, what could emerge from her etheric body due to her roots in Russian culture was encompassed and encapsulated in an English quality, English culture, and appears in her books in a mode informed by this Englishness. But the important thing here is what happened between these two extremes. To understand what happened, we must realize that in Western Europe, especially instigated by British culture, the study of occult and esoteric knowledge was always widespread. In terms of English history, we can say that extensive occult studies were always pursued. In the whole development of its spiritual culture, Central Europe really has no proper idea of the incisive nature of occult study that has always proceeded from the land of Britain and spread across Western Europe, across Southern Europe too, and so on. If we wish to understand how things really are, we will have to take a look at this especially British tinge of occultism. This British hue of occultism certainly exists. The external facts known about all kinds of high-ranking orders of Scottish Freemasonry and so on are in fact only the outer aspects that are revealed to the world. Behind these externalities stand occult schools that work in a really comprehensive way, and to a far greater degree than in Central Europe. These schools absorbed and incorporated old occult traditions and occult streams. In Central Europe, as you have seen from many various public lectures, people strive more to rise from their own spirituality to spiritual perception, a perception of spiritual worlds. This has been their inevitable striving. Here, people have depended less on what has come down to them from elsewhere, especially from older occult schools. If we look back through the centuries, in particular to the beginning of the 17th century, we find across England, Scotland, and Ireland, less so there, but certainly in Scotland, widespread occult communities that have perpetuated, promulgated, and in some sense reconstituted the occult knowledge of very ancient times. If we wish to properly understand the reason for the reconfiguring of this knowledge, we need to know that the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, that of Greek and Roman culture and so forth, which lasted until the beginning of the 15th century, had in a purely human way to inwardly assimilate the spiritual revelation that existed in former ages. What humankind received as revelations had to be spiritually assimilated during this fourth epoch. Then the fifth post-Atlantean era arrived, coinciding with the beginning of the 15th century. At this point, the human being needed to start focusing more upon the outer world, living more on the physical plane and elaborating fewer new concepts. All the ideas and concepts we possess today come from the fourth post-Atlantean era and have all been passed down to us. No new concepts have been formed since the 15th century. Not a single really new idea has been formulated, but the old concepts have just been applied to phenomena and processes in new ways. Darwinism did not produce a new concept of evolution, but simply applied it to certain processes. Since the beginning of the 15th century, no really new concept has arisen. All ideas and concepts emerged in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. In the fifth post-Atlantean era, our focus was to be on the external, physical world, the physical plane. And the British people were especially fitted for this task. And the late stage at which this people's distinctive trait emerged in the British Isles was precisely what fitted them for it. At the beginning of the 15th century, a threat developed, the risk that a kind of confusion would emerge. The purely physical endeavors of British culture threatened to be confounded by a much more spiritual striving, one fruitfully informed by a spiritual life originating in very ancient times. This was at the time that parts of the Kingdom of France were still under English rule, English dominion enforced from the other side of the Channel. To bring about a real sundering or separation, the world of spirit played its part in the appearance of Joan of Arc, the Maid of Orleans, whose task, in a sense, was to bring and create order from the world of spirit at the beginning of the 15th century, when she appeared. Indeed, it is true to say that the whole outward nature of Europe depends, as I said also on a previous occasion here, on this appearance of the Maid of Orleans. It was precisely then that British and French culture were sundered. Hitherto the Angles and Saxons migrating to Britain under the legendary but in fact occult leadership of Hengist and Horsa had been ruled really by a Norman and Roman element, especially a Roman element, and represented a subordinate stratum of society. The British culture predominant today, predominant especially since the 17th century, at that time, formed an understratum so strong that while the French element still dominated and the French spirit, in a sense, still held dominion over the British Isles, an aristocracy existed which profoundly disdained anything that originated only from the Angles and Saxons. In the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, for instance, a curse commonly used by this dominant class, still living at the time over the sea in France, in the French-Norman bloodline, was, quote, "God condemn me for an Englishman," close quote. That was a widely used curse. To be a respectable person, one wished to be anything other than an Englishman in the British Isles. This only changed fully after the division I described occurred, and English culture emerged more strongly. Now, diverse events occurred, it would take too long to describe them in detail, behind which profound spiritual forces held sway, the Wars of the Roses, the White and the Red. The important thing is that at the beginning of the 17th century, after Shakespeare had written his plays, especially those concerned with kingship and the Wars of the Roses, and the whole battle between the White and Red factions lives in these Shakespeare plays, a soul incarnated in a physical body in Britain at the end of the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century. Outwardly, this person was not of great importance, but nevertheless exerted great far-reaching stimulus and influence. this soul in whom there was really little British blood, but a confluence of French and Scottish ancestry, was able to exert an especially stimulating effect. From this individual emanated an impulse both for exoteric and esoteric British culture. And thus this esoteric British culture developed, naturally with many diverse intermediary processes that it would take too long to describe. I said that this spiritual culture was a continuation of the occult streams of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. This tradition encompassed a huge amount of knowledge, providing, in fact, the foundation for the predominant importance given to the body, while the etheric body was relegated to a much more subsidiary role. The physical body was here regarded as the instrument for all spiritual life, and for this very reason there was no means in these occult schools themselves to experience very much of the world of spirit. Yet these occult schools preserved ancient traditions, all that had been handed down from ancient clairvoyant seers, and they sought to permeate this with concepts. And so there developed an occult science which really only worked with experiences passed down from seers in the fourth and even the third post-Atlantean epoch. What such seers had achieved was imbued with purely physical concepts, with the conceptual material one has if one thinks only by means of the physical body. Thus a curious kind of occult science arose, but one which, nevertheless, extended across all domains of life. Now, it is interesting to take a somewhat closer look at certain aspects of this occult science. As I told you, I am relating nothing but facts. It is worth considering what was taught there concerning the destiny of the people of Europe. Let me try to characterize the teachings that were given. Of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, knowledge of which was passed down by tradition, it was said that this epoch had been bursting with spiritual life, had produced the conceptual world of humankind, its views of society, all kinds of things, that this era had been imbued with spiritual life. It had developed in southern Europe on the Greek peninsula, on the Italian peninsula, and spread far and wide from there. The people of central Europe, western Europe, were still in their cultural infancy at the time the fourth post-Atlantean epoch blossomed, still infants of humanity in a spiritual sense. I am telling you only what was taught in these occult schools. The peoples of Central and Western Europe were infants in respect of spiritual life and culture and in relation to the achievements spreading from the cultural centers of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. Gradually, these peoples of Western and Central Europe worked their way out of an infant state, becoming ever more mature as the Renaissance and the Reformation arrived. I do not mean the German Reformation, but the English one under James I and so forth. And so these Central and Western European peoples freed themselves. And now a very particular dogma developed within these esoteric schools, which they adhered to with utter faith. And this was that in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, Anglo-Saxon culture will become ascendant in the place of Greco-Roman culture. Repeatedly, it was emphasized that there had been a fourth post-Atlantean epoch and now a fifth, that Greco-Roman culture set the tone in the fourth epoch, but that what flows from the nature of Anglo-Saxon culture must set the tone for the fifth. Anglo-Saxon culture, it was said, must hold spiritual sway over the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. And everything conceived in relation to humanity's evolution must help to realize this dogma. In Eastern Europe, as taught in these schools, People lived in the same conditions in which the peoples of Central and Western Europe lived when they received Greco-Roman culture from the Romans. In Eastern Europe, the Slavic peoples today, it was said, live in their infancy. All who belong to these schools regard this Eastern European culture as being in an infant state and consider that what comes in future will involve these Eastern Europeans working their way toward greater maturity in a way similar to that in which Central and Western Europeans formerly did. But, and here I may use the actual words spoken in these schools, just as the Romans were the spiritual nursemaids to Western and Central Europe, so now Anglo-Saxon culture must become the nursemaid to Eastern European culture, guiding it out of its infancy into a more mature spiritual phase of life. Here they make a distinction similar to the way the Germanic peoples were differentiated into Goths and so forth, according to which the Slavic peoples will also become differentiated. In awareness of the existence of inner powers that point to certain future configurations, they describe how in Russia itself, the people very demonstrably live in a kind of infancy, since, just as formerly in Central and Western Europe, a number of local regions and municipalities are only artificially held together within a nation-state. Yet on the other hand, a people held together only by its religion, the Poles, would, despite their endeavors, ultimately be summoned, as stated, I am only speaking of what is actually taught in these schools, to be incorporated into Russian culture. In these schools, this is a point of keen persuasion, that the whole Polish nation must be incorporated into Russian culture. For instance, they say, and again, this is quite literal, that in the neighborhood of the valley of the Lower Danube, various Slavic nations formed isolated kingdoms. However, these independent Slavic nations will, say these schools, only endure until the next great European war that is to come. In other words, there were widespread teachings of a great European war that would create havoc and disorder, and the independence of these Slavic states would only last until that point. And the whole issue is presented as if something not yet existing in the present, and please remember that these are teachings that were given through the centuries already, and so I am speaking, as it were, from a past present in reference to a future, which has already to some extent arrived, will come about in future and gradually give rise to a quite different form of cohesion between these Eastern European peoples as they grow from infancy to greater maturity. These were the teachings repeatedly disseminated and always in existence. They were not taken merely theoretically, but were inculcated in those who belonged to these schools in such a way that led numerous people to try to configure and influence outward life so that facts and realities would also be shaped in accordance with these teachings. And here it would be interesting to cite historical facts showing how such realities can be created in a particular context. People usually have absolutely no idea that things which arise alongside each other have actually been conceived together, organized together. In occult fraternities, such as those in the British Empire, of which I am speaking, which encompass broad swathes of the population, including ruling groups and figures, and which have their affiliates and adherents throughout Western Europe and in Italy, it is known that each person has their own particular task, that each acts in a particular way in life. It is well known what this signifies. Let me give you a specific example. On the one hand, English statesmen gradually formed friendships with certain statesmen in a smaller state of the Danube region, a part of Austria. It is well known in these circles what it means to arrange things so that a friendly relationship develops and a certain belief forms in a Danube state, in the security of particular institutions in the British Empire, giving rise to the view that these institutions are good ones. But one does not do this alone. At the same time and alongside it, one does something else. For example, one ensures that an influential book is published that contains very derogatory things about the people who live in the Danube state. Thus, with one hand, one nurtures it, and with the other, does the opposite. Something like this has significance if undertaken methodically. Cultivating a friendship which can develop some cultural significance, and on the other hand, greatly accentuating the negative qualities of the same people. A devilish undertaking, you may say, and indeed, Ahrimanic powers are at work in it. This is how things are done that seemingly are only coincidental. A member of such a fraternity writes a book that becomes influential, sets in motion a dire effect and movement, while another makes efforts to engender and secure the friendship of the same people whom the book disparages. Thus movements are at work behind the scenes of outer life, and people have no idea how such fraternities act with a view to making a particular nation, in this case the British nation, into a ruling and dominant power. Now, imagine an individual like Blavatsky entering this context of occult fraternities. Members of these fraternities, who knew the whole nature of occultism from tradition, if not from any fruitful intuition, would learn of the existence of such an individual. To ordinary people who know nothing of occultism, Blavatsky will appear as a rather baroque individual, a little abnormal. But she does not appear so to the occultists, even those of an Ahrimanic persuasion, like those I have been speaking of. These people know that someone of her kind emerges out of all the developmental powers at work in humanity. This means that an individual emerges in whom the ether body can act in the way described at a time when a very great deal is occurring and unfolding. It is, you see, a time when the greatest conceivable distrust is shown toward those who simply speak of the world of spirit. Little credence will be given in our time, for the many reasons I have given, to those who simply stand up as we should, again for reasons I have given, and with full justification speak of the world of spirit. It was not in the interests of the occult fraternities centered in British culture and spreading outward from there to cultivate an honest striving for the truth. They were, above all, interested in spiritual truths being communicated to the world, truths originating, therefore, in the world of spirit, in a way that was much more tangible and down to earth. These truths, in their view, should be adapted in a way favorable to the theories taught as dogma by the ruling Anglo-Saxon classes of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. Thus, in the 1860s and at the beginning of the 1870s, these occult fraternities sought to use Blavatsky to present to the world spiritual truths of a sort that could be seen to arise not from a perfectly ordinary human brain, but from an etheric body, and additionally, as a purely future element, from one that had developed within a culture that possesses the foundations for the sixth post-Atlantean epoch. But since this future element does not as yet have full self-possession in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, people thought they could arrange things in the following way. They thought they could influence Blavatsky, who, being, as I described, is not an ordinary medium, but who can, nevertheless, be influenced by ordinary mediumistic powers, so that these British fraternities could ensure that she would speak in a way they wanted her to, rather than as she would when left to her own devices. Instead of these British fraternities themselves appearing before the world and simply announcing that British culture should be dominant, they point to her as an individual who has emerged and who apparently out of her own etheric body introduces a new science, entirely new concepts. In fact, through the influence of these occult fraternities, these new concepts were to be formulated and shaped precisely so as to show Anglo-Saxon culture as the decisive and predominant element of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. That was the aim. And the dogma these fraternities subscribed to made them think their conduct was entirely appropriate. They were taking a Russian woman, a Russian soul, and treating her like an infant, supervising her like a nursemaid, and cultivating her by means of Western European occultism. The whole thing was embedded in their dogma. Their aim was to present to the world a new occult science, but one at the same time that seemed to the Western fraternities a suitable means to achieve their particular ends. All would have run smoothly if Blavatsky had been only Russian. They could have molded her to their ends if she had been. But, as I said, there was a certain pinch of Central European quality in her. She was far too independent. I cannot trace every detail of the leverage they tried to exert on her to achieve what they sought, but she always repeatedly foiled them. Since all the things that lived in her etheric body naturally came to her awareness, she would not have contemplated going to London, for instance, to join an occult fraternity, and letting herself be trained as a higher medium. This is what the occult fraternities wanted, but she would never have agreed to it. Having initially undergone very fine and proper guidance, during which much developed and was continuing to develop very well in her, the whole thing was arranged so that she entered a high-level order in Paris, one, however, that was subordinate to British occult streams. There, she was to be prepared in a way that would allow what people desired to emerge from her soul. But as I said, there was an independent streak in her, and she thwarted the aims they had for her, as she had done previously. She issued conditions for her work in the order that could not possibly be met, that cannot possibly be fulfilled without invoking an absolute storm. And hardly had this process begun, therefore, than she was excluded again. And yet by that time already, retaining her independence and acuity to a certain degree, she had absorbed important aspects of secrets that exist within such occult orders. And then, if I can put it like this, she developed a taste for the whole role. In a sense, she found it agreeable to play a very initial occult role. But she did not wish to become only a higher medium. She also wanted to direct the whole thing herself. And at this point she entered an American order. One cannot describe everything she sought to instigate and to some degree did inaugurate within this American order. Now she was an insider in it. She learned countless secrets which until then only high-grade members of the order had been party to. A particular intention was at work and this was still being pursued. All this led to her receiving a huge quantity of knowledge. Imagine it, a whole new situation was thereby created. There was now an individual who possessed an endless amount of occult knowledge that occult orders had hitherto kept as secrets. This situation was really an entirely new one. But now she did something in America that made it impossible for her to remain in the order or to work further with it. She showed that she wished to use this occult knowledge that she had gained in a way which the order could not agree to. It was quite impossible for them to agree to this, for it would have led to utter confusion, if they had let her continue as she wished. Instead, they resorted to something very dubious that is used really only very, very rarely. They placed her in occult imprisonment. This good, poor Blavatsky, who, as you see, was a plaything of all kinds of powers, this occult imprisonment, achieved through certain means employed in ceremonial magic, allows those imposing it to ensure that everything the soul in question develops reaches only as far as a certain sphere, where it is repulsed. Everything the person in question inwardly develops can be seen only by himself, and he is unable to communicate it in any way to the outer world. It remains something isolated within him, assimilated within him. This is a very curious matter, but the decision was made to impose this on Blavatsky, to render her harmless, thus preventing her communicating all sorts of things to the world, and ensuring her whole endeavor was repulsed. This is called the repulse of endeavor, or occult imprisonment. The decision was made in 1879 at a gathering of occultists from various countries and imposed upon Blavatsky. For many years, therefore, Blavatsky did really live in this occult imprisonment. It is unnecessary to recount her outward circumstances during this period, since to an external view nothing of what I am relating may be discerned. Now certain Indian occultists were concerned to free her from this occult imprisonment. And this was the beginning of the period during which Blavatsky first embarked on an Indian path. Everything I have so far related is really Blavatsky's early history, and only now did she embark on the developments with which people are familiar. Everything that is hard to comprehend about her is connected with what I have described. Indian occultists who were endeavoring to save her from the grip of British interests employed certain means to dissolve the occult imprisonment. In fact, this was undertaken with the accord of those who had previously imposed this imprisonment on her. And the result of this for Blavatsky was that now, in a sense, everything streamed into her soul that was connected only with Indian occultism. I must continually emphasize the fact that we really are speaking here about revealed secrets of the world of spirit, which manifest, however, in all kinds of distorted pictures and caricatures. It would be wrong to think that they do not reveal great occult secrets. Naturally, with the huge powers that held sway in Blavatsky through her innate disposition, and then also through all she had experienced and undergone, the Indian occult truths manifested in her to a very distinct degree. In Blavatsky, therefore, we have a specific instance of British occultism, Anglo-Saxon interests, endeavoring to pursue their predominance by using a soul such as that of Blavatsky, which they regard as embodying an infant culture. All this seeks to completely overlook Central Europe, to ride roughshod over it and ignore it. These secret societies really do speak as I have recounted to you, and regard what I have so far described as the Central European stream, as something that must be discounted and sidelined. Thus, through Blavatsky, there appeared a form of occult knowledge in many respects dubious and contestable, a kind of kaleidoscope of dazzling colors, through which, as you can see from all I have described, political intentions were working. The conditions Blavatsky sought in Paris were pursued with political intentions. And likewise, what she was trying to do in America had a political aim. If I were to characterize Blavatsky's intentions in Paris and America, I would say that this involved the inner opposition of her Russian nature to a dependency of Russian culture on Western Europe and America. This was why she tried to assert a requirement in Paris that cannot be met, and would have led to a political convulsion in France. In America, she herself did not seek to impose the condition, but instead she formed an alliance with someone who had high standing in the political domain, with Alcott, in order to pursue all kinds of political machinations, but with the aid of a pervasive and manifest occultism. All these measures sought to realize endeavors that had been differently pursued under the guidance of Blavatsky's masked, original leader, of whom it is very difficult indeed to speak. This original leader wished to guide Blavatsky into the proper channel, but then he was replaced by another who was anything other than what Blavatsky called a Mahatma, really a completely different figure. And so, through the most varied forces working together here, a confused text emerged from Blavatsky, the title Secret Doctrine. And yet it is one that also contains countless great mighty truths. This book was also capable of having great influence in Central Europe. You see, and this is apparent, for instance, in a very important novel by George Sand, secret societies, fraternities pervaded by occultism, play a great role in political movements in Western Europe, albeit often in outwardly imperceptible ways, a subterranean kind of influence. At the end of my public lecture on Friday, I hinted that such things are playing their part in current events. Political conspiracies and all sorts of other related things play an important role. As I said at the public lecture, we can point to conspiracies that draw on underground occult streams and foundations, connected, for instance, with the murder of Jarret and a whole host of other things that I mentioned last Friday. Also, the murder of Franz Ferdinand, and so on. All these things, usually hidden from the outer world, are involved in a whole loop of plots and conspiracies centered in London and spun across Western Europe as far as Southern Europe and the Balkan countries, ending in St. Petersburg. As I said, these things should not be regarded so much in historical terms like other historical facts, but more as things that can shed some light on various events. What we should remember, above all, is that powers at work in the world of spirit, and only manifesting in the physical world, play through a soul such as that of Blavatsky. We should discern quite especially how such a soul is gripped by what plays below the surface of the physical plane, how it is carried along on its current, revealing powers at work in historical evolution. I am sure it is clear to you from the many reflections we have engaged in together here that we must gradually become familiar with such realities. Today I was obliged to speak of these matters so that you might see how many of the events of the world and their determining causes remain hidden from view if we do not try to look deeper than people usually do. Under the surface of events run quite different currents, and in a sense we remain blind if we penetrate no further than the surface. The astonishment people invariably feel at events that occur at any particular time would be much diminished if they engaged with the deeper currents and deeper powers at work behind them. But unfortunately, the state of affairs today is that many concern themselves only with the apparently linear stream of outward events, unaware that it is repeatedly convulsed and interrupted as if by a vortex surfacing from the depths, while, on the other hand, there are people who are interested in all kinds of occult matters, but only in their sensational aspects, because this grips their interest. Very few people today have any perception that what we can discern in the occult domain can be endlessly enlightening when we seek to understand what is happening in the outer world. Some are extremely interested in the life of Blavatsky, while others are not in the least interested in her, but instead concern themselves only with outward facts that occur on the physical plane. But if we see how these events are connected with deeper realities, as I was only able to hint at today, we can gain greater insights, and this is important. We are moving toward a time when increasing numbers of people will seek to penetrate and perceive the deeper currents of existence, having the goodwill to do so. And within our movement, it is particularly necessary to see things such as those I have spoken of in the right light. Immediately after the war broke out, a pupil of Blavatsky, Mrs. Annie Besant, railed in very extreme terms in her English journals against what lives in our anthroposophic movement. The way in which she upbraided us showed clearly that the factions she belonged to could not for a moment imagine that our honest esotericism, in its pure search for truth, was not sullied by political interests. But political elements can never play into our quest for truth. It can have a connection with politics only in so far as truth in general can inform politics, but not in the sense I indicated in relation to the Western European fraternities. Basically, our movement could only have the mission of sundering those who can be sundered from the influence of these Western European fraternities. But in these factions to which Besant belongs, people cannot conceive of anything occurring without impure political motives. Thus, it was related entirely wrongly that from 1909 onward I had intended to become the president of the whole Theosophical Society and to go to India so that I might influence politics from there. On the one hand, therefore, I'd be jumping on the Berlin-Baghdad train, and on the other, developing anthroposophy. I am not telling you fairy tales. Assuming a most indignant and angry pose, these circles asserted that I would gradually have won over all the officials of the Theosophical Society, which was very widespread there at the time, so as to exert a political influence to further the aims of pan-Germanism. In other words, I would have attacked England from my position in India. You can read this in Mrs. Besant's essays. And now the whole thing is being repeated in a still more extreme fashion. You see, therefore, that these people can only think in such ways, and that gradually a sense of truth, of pure, objective, honest striving for truth, inevitably gets lost. The kinds of things said by Mrs. Besant can only be called objective untruths. But actually, I ought to go a good deal further in the forcefulness of my expressions, for to speak of, quote, objective untruth, close quote, in relation to the nonsensical accusations by the Jesuits, with which you are by now very familiar, falls far short of what is needed. But then something else must be considered, too. In 1909 in Budapest, I had something very particular to say to Mrs. Besant. At the time, people were seeking to make a compromise with me with a view to making this figure of Alcyone into the bearer of Christ. By way of compromise, if I were to agree with this, they would make me into the reincarnated Saint John the Evangelist. This would have been enshrined in their dogmas if I had agreed to engage with all their deceitful ploys. But countering all these developments, an international association of honest people formed. They included Mr. Keitley, who in the past had always edited Mrs. Besant's books and corrected their factual errors. This international association, based in India, asked me to become its president. And in 1909 in Budapest, I said to Mrs. Besant that I would not, for a moment, work within an occult movement in any other way than in relation to German culture. only in connection with German culture, within Central Europe. I said this to Mrs. Besant in 1909. Nevertheless, after war broke out, she wrote the things I described. Here it is no longer a matter of objective untruth, but of an intentional lie, since I had expressly stated my position. An intentional lie rather than an objective untruth. This is the path one is led down if one does not stand firm on the ground of pure truth, of honest, incontrovertible truth, when entering the domain of spiritual truths. Everything depends on the way in which occult streams must enter the world in accordance with the needs of human evolution. This necessity and acknowledgement of it is the all-important thing. When Mrs. Besant first arrived in Germany to give a lecture in Hamburg, she also spoke in a smaller circle. At the time I asked Mrs. Besant a question, and the fact that I remember such things is no doubt sometimes very unpleasant for people. I asked her about the great and powerful tradition of German occultism that connected so strongly with German culture at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries. Mrs. Besant replied, and as I said, this was during her very first visit to Germany, that what emerged in Germany was a failed attempt in occultism, which surfaced in other forms. And because it failed, it had to be undertaken in England instead, so that occultism could now be brought back to Europe from England. You see how politics insinuates itself into these things, and how we must be aware of them. What I have said to you today is intended as a kind of introduction to reflections that will, however, take us in a somewhat different direction. They will, though, lead us to matters of equal historical importance, such as esoteric perception of the individual human being, of which we will speak more next time. The end of Lecture 3.